In June 2020, the New England Journal of Medicine published an article calling for reconsideration of the widespread use of race in clinical algorithms. Since then, many race-adjusted clinical tools have been scrutinized and replaced with new race-neutral versions, sometimes amid contentious debate. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Darshali Vyas, a pulmonary and critical care fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Vyas was an author of the 2020 article and has co-authored a new Medicine and Society article reflecting on progress and continued challenges in addressing race-based medicine. Dr. Vyas, when you wrote your 2020 article, what did you and your co-authors learn about the prevalence of race correction in clinical algorithms?
One of the biggest motivations of that paper was to reflect on how the more that we dug into this topic, the more that we saw it wasn't just in one tool or just confined to one part of medicine. And that really highlighted that it was really quite ubiquitous across medicine as an accepted way of incorporating race into how we make clinical decisions.
So, what were the reasons for including race in those tools when they were first designed?
When you look back at some of the validation studies for those tools, the reasoning really differs. In some cases, the tool developers actually don't mention a reason or give an explanation at all. And in other instances, tool developers are trying to study large data sets and look at a clinical outcome of interest. So that could be, for example, looking at everyone that trials a vaginal birth after a prior cesarean and looking at everyone who's successful at that clinical outcome. So everyone who has a successful vaginal birth. And then the tool developers look at these very large data sets and try to identify which patient characteristics make us more likely to have a successful outcome. And so, in doing that analysis, it's not surprising that race and ethnicity appears as a data signal. We know very well that there are different outcomes based on race and ethnicity in this country. It's unfortunate and it's something worth investing in and trying to repair. But in some of these analyses, when a data signal appears for race, tool developers then would make the decision to actually adjust the clinical algorithms or risk tools for those variables, making it less likely to predict a successful vaginal birth for a woman who is Black rather than white. And that was sort of the accepted line of reasoning given for many of these tools. Tool developers argued that they were reflecting the empiric data that's in front of them. But we argued that by building these race factors into predictive modeling, that we risk perpetuating these disparities further into the future.
So, how did both racial justice advocates and members of the scientific community respond to your identification of this widespread use of race in clinical algorithms?
I think that's one of the successes of this movement is just in reflecting 5 years later on how many groups of people were mobilized by this. From the onset, medical students and young trainees were really sounding this call even before professional societies became involved and before the government took notice of this issue. And that has always been at the core of this movement, trainees seeing a disconnect between how we're learning about race and how we see it being used clinically. And that has always been the start of this movement. We were lucky that this issue also attracted federal attention from Congress, and actually from both sides of Congress, from the House and the Senate. And that we had mentors who helped make that happen, specifically Dr. Michelle Morse. After this issue attracted federal attention from Congress, there was then a concerted effort to ask professional societies to individually respond and to account for their use of race and to reconsider it. The result of those efforts was a hearing in Congress and then the launch of widespread professional society working groups that work to re-examine and very rigorously reevaluate the evidence base behind race correction and their use of race in their respective tools. And as we reflect on in this paper, the conclusion of those efforts and those working groups included the recommendation that race be removed from 8 of the 13 tools that we discussed in 2020. And so I think this really highlights the dramatic progress over the last 5 years, but also really the fundamental balance between racial justice advocacy being paired with a very rigorous scientific reevaluation of the use of race.
So you say 8 of 13 tools have seen race removed. In what fields has the most progress been made, and in what fields does race-based medicine persist?
And I guess I'll just sort of clarify. I think 8 of the 13 tools we discussed have had recommendations to remove race. And one of the things we touch on in our paper is that that recommendation doesn't always neatly translate to an immediate change that physicians or patients may see instantaneously. There are still a lot of implementation barriers that exist between a professional society recommendation and actually changing that on the ground. The changes that we have seen really span many fields of medicine. The first tools to abandon race-based correction included the vaginal birth after cesarean calculator, so in obstetrics and gynecology. We've seen a change in kidney disease with the use of EGFR and the official recommendation to stop race-based reporting of EGFR. We've seen success in pulmonary function testing with a national working group that officially recommended moving away from race-based interpretation of pulmonary function testing. So really the progress has been just kind of mirroring how broad the problem was to begin with. The success has also touched on different fields of medicine. There are other tools that we mentioned in our 2020 paper that have not yet revised their tools or have revised their tools and not chosen to remove race. So one example would be the Society for Thoracic Surgeons, a clinical tool that helps estimate preoperative morbidity and mortality. They actually have since revamped their tools online, but have continued to use race. So that's one example.
You say in your article that campaigns to end race correction must contend with the responsibilities of disclosure and redress for patients who may have been negatively affected by race-adjusted algorithms. So what approaches have been used or could be used?
I think that this, again, gets to some of the barriers of implementation. Just because a tool is changed on a website or in a laboratory in a hospital doesn't mean that patients whose diagnostic categories may have changed are actually aware of those changes. And so I think an outstanding question that will face sort of the next phase of this movement is how we discuss these changes with our patients once they are implemented. How do we, in a patient interaction between a patient and their physician, talk about the fact that pulmonary function testing interpretation has changed, and now someone who is perhaps characterized as normal lung function is now characterized as abnormal? There hasn't been a concerted or standardized approach to this. And so I think there are many sort of propositions of how this could be done. But I think the first is really centering disclosure in general, making sure that patients are notified of this and are prioritized if their categorization has changed, that we're thinking about how to bring those patients into clinic, into care, and having time and space to have those conversations. And pairing that with getting them the testing and treatment that they need, especially in cases where escalation of care may have been delayed by the use of race-based correction. There have been other examples of reparative approaches to try to prioritize patients who were potentially harmed from race-based correction. One of the most striking examples of this is through the United Network for Organ Sharing, or UNOS, that actually explicitly acknowledged by using race-corrected EGFR, this may have underestimated the severity of kidney disease among Black patients who are waiting for kidney transplants. And not only have they found a way to notify those patients, but they're actually working to redress that harm by giving them wait time modifications for patients so they accrue time that they may have missed on their kidney transplant list. Thinking about how to incorporate a restorative or reparative approach into how we notify our patients is an outstanding question in the field.
How do you respond to contentions that changes to these tools either take resources away from white patients or represent a movement toward race-blind medicine?
I think the idea that the call for removing race correction from our clinical tools represents race-blind medicine is, I think, a deep misunderstanding of the movement. Removing race from clinical tools does not by any means mean that we're advocating for ignoring race in the ways that it impacts our patients. In fact, we continue to believe that investing in research that looks at racial disparities and the way that different racial groups experience health outcomes is incredibly important. Moreover, studying and tracking racial disparities over time is really the only way that we can know if we're making progress and knowing which groups to invest resources and interventions in. Where we do exert caution is in using race in predictive modeling, which almost accepts racial disparities rather than investing in fighting them. And secondly, I would say for the concern of taking away resources from white patients to Black patients, I would think of the movement to remove race correction as a recalibration of tools. So tools that are being revised now and having race taken out of them, those are examples in which race was incorrectly included in the first place. Our goal for these sorts of tools and clinical decision making in general is to have tools that help physicians make the most accurate, scientific, evidence-based decisions about their health. This is beneficial not only for Black patients or patients of color, but beneficial for all patients to have our tools direct resources only to patients that need them and to direct them towards patients that need them the most. So I would think of it as recalibrating resources and tools that were falsely including race rather than redistributing.
Thank you, Dr. Vias. Funding for this podcast is provided by the Doris Duke Foundation, committed to building a creative, equitable, and sustainable future.